The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for their support. And this morning's first reading is, oh, you're going to like this, The Math Behind the Perfect Free Throw. A basketball computer program simulates millions of trajectories in search of the ideal shot, by Larry Silverberg. Some 20 years ago, my colleague Dr. Chow Tran and I developed a way to simulate the trajectories of millions of basketballs on the computer. We went to the coaches and assistant coaches at North Carolina State University, where we are based, and told them we had this uncommon ability to study basketball shots very carefully. Their first question was simple. What's the best free throw? Should the shooter aim towards the front of the hoop or the back? Does it depend on whether the shooter is short or tall? Math offers a unique perspective. It speeds up the amount of time it takes to see the patterns behind the best shots. For the most part, we discovered things that the players and coaches already knew, but every so often we came across a new insight. From a mathematical point of view, basketball is a game of trajectories. These trajectories are unique in that the ball's motion doesn't change much when it's flying through the air, but then rapidly changes over milliseconds when the ball collides with the hoop or the backboard. To simulate millions of trajectories without the code taking too long to run, we tried any trick we could think of. We figured out how to go from modestly changing motion to rapidly changing motion, such as when the ball bounces off the rim or off the backboard. We learned how to turn large numbers of trajectories into statistical probabilities. We even created fictitious trajectories in which the ball magically passes through all of the physical obstacles, hoop, backboard, backplate, except for one, to see where it collides first. The free throw was the first shot that my colleague and I decided studied in detail. In close games, teams can win and lose at the free throw line. What's more, the free throw is uncontested, so perfection in the free throw can pay off big. Top teams tend to shoot the free shot well. Our program could tell us what chances the shooter had in sinking a free throw and help us figure out what he was doing right or wrong. Breaking down the free throw. We studied the free throw for about 5 years. One of the first things we learned from our simulations and by watching TV footage was that players with the same consistency can shoot free throws from anywhere from 75 to 90% accuracy. The difference was that the 90% players were being consistent at the right shot, the best trajectory. The fate of a free throw is set the instant the ball leaves the player's fingertips, so we look closely at the launch conditions of the shot. The ball is located at some height above the floor. It has a rate at which it is spinning backwards, called backspin, and it has a launch speed and a launch angle. Since the shooter never launches the ball the same way, small differences account for a shooter's consistency. We found that about 3 hertz of backspin is the best amount. More than that does not help. It takes about 1 second for the ball to reach the basket, so 3 hertz equates to 3 revolutions in the air from the instant the ball leaves the player's hands to when it reaches the basket. Next, assuming the player releases the ball at 7 feet above the ground, a launch angle of about 52 degrees is best. In that angle, the launch speed is the lowest, and the probability of the shot being successful is the greatest. At 52 degrees, the shooter can be off a degree or more either way without a large effect on the shot's success. However, launch speed is quite the opposite. it's the hardest variable for a player to control. Release the ball too slowly and the shot is short. Release it too fast and the shot is long. A player needs to memorize the motion of her entire body during release to impart the same speed consistency. All else being the same, players who release from higher above the floor have a higher shooting percentage. That's interesting because our coaches at NC State and others say that taller players tend to shoot the free throw worse than shorter players do. It seems that the shorter players must try harder. The last release condition was the most surprising, the aim point of the free throw. We found that the player should aim the ball to the back of the rim. Basically, the back of the rim is more forgiving than the front of the rim. At a release height of 7 feet, the gap between the ball and the back of the ring should be less than 2 inches. A small gap is best, whether launching at low or high release heights. Lessons learned. So what does this all mean for players out there aspiring to improve their free throw? Our research suggests that players should aim the ball beyond the center of the rim, launch the ball at a high angle and as high above the ground as possible. The ball at the highest point of its arc should reach the top of the backboard. Line up the ball to eliminate the side angle and try to launch the ball with smooth body motion to produce a consistent launch speed. In the past few years, we've expanded our work to study where the best bank shots strike the backboard and developed a tool for anyone who wants to perfect it. With tournament play approaching, I'm reminded of how competitive the game has become and how it has truly become a game of inches. As an old basketball player, like many of you, I enjoy watching the game and every so often catching a glimpse of that perfect free throw. By Larry Silverberg, Professor of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering, North Carolina State University. And that's two readings in a row where we have North Carolina-oriented stories. Up next, Smart News, keeping you current. For the only person ever hit by a meteorite, the real trouble began later. The Hodges meteorite brought problems to the woman it struck, but good fortune to at least one neighbor, by Kat Eschner. Only one person in recorded history has ever been directly hit by a meteorite. Anne Hodges, 34, was napping under quilts on her couch in Sylacauga, Alabama, on November 30, 1954, when a 9-pound meteorite came through the ceiling and bounced off a radio before hitting her in the thigh. It left a deep bruise and catapulted her into both quiet fame and a major legal dispute with her landlady, who thought she rightfully owned the rock. Anne's bruise, seen in a photo in Time, looks painful, but the real trouble started for Anne after the meteorite struck, writes Phil Blate for Slate. Between the protracted court battle with her landlady and the media attention, Hodges' mental and physical health went downhill, he writes. She separated from her husband and eventually died of kidney failure in a nursing home at the age of 52. The meteorite did bring good fortune to one of her neighbors. Julius Kempis McKinney, a local farmer, found a chunk of the Hodges meteorite that was less than half as big as the one that struck the woman it was then named after. McKinney told his postman, writes the Decatur Daily, who helped him get a lawyer to negotiate the sale of his find. In the end, he made enough money to buy a car and a house. Another neighbor, Bill Field, told the Daily, he remembered seeing the meteorite as a 5-year-old. I was standing in the backyard with my mother, who was at the clothesline, he told the newspaper. I remember this object shooting across the sky with a white tail, and I pointed it out to my mother. There was a loud boom and black smoke. 62 years after her brush with the heavens, Hodges remains the only well-documented case of somebody being hit by a meteorite. But humans have continued to be affected by space junk. In 1992, a meteorite blazed across the sky in Peekskill, New York, before striking a woman's parked car. The repair bill probably stung a bit, but she wasn't injured in the strike. In 2003, a 40-pound meteorite crashed through the roof of another home, this time in New Orleans, though fortunately no one was hurt. And in 2007, a meteorite strike made people sick in Peru when it released arsenic fumes from an underground water source, writes Brian Howard for National Geographic. In 2013, a meteorite exploded over central Russia. The resulting shockwave injured 1,200 people and caused $33 million in damage. As Hodge's unique case demonstrates, the odds are on our side when it comes to meteor strikes. One scientist found the lifetime odds of dying from a meteor strike near you to be 1 in 1,600,000. To put that in perspective, your odds of being struck by lightning are 1 in 135,000. The odds of dying as a result of a meteor strike anywhere in the world, like the kind of rare but catastrophic geologic event that shapes an eon, are 1 in 75,000. Kat Eschner is a freelance science and culture journalist based in Toronto. Here's one reader's comment about that story. The car hit by the Peekskill meteorite had just been purchased by the 18-year-old owner from her grandmother for a few hundred dollars and was sold shortly after the impact for at least $10,000. Over the years, I saw different amounts quoted in different sources. The meteorite itself sold for $69,000, so the repair bill for the car was not really an issue. And another reader comments, the Life article, not Time, says that the meteor was seized by the Air Force, who swooped in by helicopter and whisked it away to Wright-Patterson Field in Ohio for analysis. It never mentions the greedy landlord. Also, the Smithsonian article implies that Ann Hodges died of the stresses caused by the meteor, but it was nearly 20 years later when she died in a nursing home of kidney failure. Another reader says, 1 in 75,000 sounds way too low. Is this missing some zeros? Up next, scientists discover a new plant organ. The structure, called a cantil, C-A-N-T-I-L, holds up the flower-bearing arm of the Thale cress, a long-studied species, by Shi Un Kim. The Thale cress may be a humble weed, but to science, it's an important model organism. Researchers use the plant as a proxy in experiments to represent other plants, animals, and even humans, thanks to its relatively short life cycle and simple genome. Scientists have even sent the Thale cross to the International Space Station and the Moon. It's the fruit fly of the plant world, says Tim Gookin, a molecular biologist who formerly worked at the Pennsylvania State University. But despite the fact that scientists have scrutinized the plant, and I'm not even going to read the Latin name of it, since the 16th century, the Thale cress still manages to surprise. Gookin and his team have found that the Thale cress produces a previously unreported plant organ, as described today in Development. This wonky-looking plant part is similar to the cantilever beams that buttress the underside of bridges and is called the cantil. The newly discovered part juts out from the stem and connects to the flower-bearing arm of the plant, which is known as the pedicel, P-E-D-I-C-E-L. Thale cress cantils give the plant the appearance of bent elbows. Cantil-less plants seem to have only straight arms. Cantils are neither part of the stem nor of the pedicel. They're an entirely new organ, says Gookin. How did scientists miss an entire plant body part all this while? One reason, Gookin concluded, is that cantils only form when the Thale cress delays its flowering, usually during the spring when daylight is limited. In this season, the theocrust transitions more slowly from the leaf production phase to the reproductive flowering stage compared to during the sunshine-filled summer. At this decelerated pace, the cantil slowly manifests at the cusp of flowering, right after the flower-tipped pedicel makes its debut. If the plant only experiences seasons with long hours of sunshine, the cantil will never make an appearance. Researchers often grow the theocrust under long daylight conditions so as to accelerate to the seed production stage, not giving time for the cantil to develop. Another reason for the cantil's obscurity is labs' widespread use of a theocrust mutant strain that doesn't produce the buttressing structure. This LER, L-E-R, strain bears a mutation in a gene that Gookin says prevents the plant from producing the part. If you base all of your research on this type of plant, you will never see the cantil because it's automatically canceled for you, says Gookin. Gookin's discovery that the cantil is a new organ comes after a painstaking 12-year investigation. When he first observed cantils in theocresses in 2008, he fretted that the part had arisen after he had mixed up his seeds, or after different strains had cross-fertilized in the lab. After several years of growing natural strains of Arabidopsis, he finally confirmed that cantil formation is a naturally occurring phenomenon. Then came the arduous investigation of identifying why natural Arabidopsis strains only bear cantils on occasion. Gookin ruled that out of the effects of the soil, water, fertilizer, and air supply. Eventually, he found that if he genetically tweaked the plants to delay their floral production, they would eventually bear crooked side stalks, cementing the role of flowering delays as the culprit behind cantils. For his discovery of the cantil's origins, he says that he hand-raised 3,782 plants and inspected over 20,000 pedicels. Gookin's hard-won findings may be the gateway to understanding cantil growth in other plants, says Diascu Ureno, a botanist at Temasek Life Sciences Laboratory, Singapore, who wasn't involved in the study. Cantils have yet to be documented in any other plants, but Ureno says that cantils or similar structures probably exist in other shrubs. Cantil formation can help us understand how plant structures are formed in general, says Nicholas Provart, a systems biologist at the University of Toronto who wasn't involved in the study. Provart says this could be important for developing more productive plant strains in agriculture. As an example of how optimizing plant structure can boost agricultural productivity, he points out that scientists cultivated shorter variants of wheat and rice strains in the 2000s that led to higher agricultural yields, as dwarfed plants are less floppy and more stable. There are definite benefits, Provart says, just by changing the architecture of plants in certain ways. While it's unclear now how the cantil itself may have any direct agricultural importance just yet, it's also just useful from a scientific perspective, says Provart. Sometimes things get discovered and then 10 years down the road or 15 years down the road, someone picks up on it. That's a little bit how science works. It's this collection of seemingly random discoveries. Provart estimates that there are roughly 78,000 papers published that involve the theocrust, so it's kind of funny to see some new parts being described after all of this research has been done, he says. Arabidopsis has been in the scientific area for years, decades, notes Ureno. Everyone uses Arabidopsis, probably more than 10,000 researchers in the world. He adds, still, scientists find a new organ. That's amazing. Shi-En Kim is a writer and researcher at the University of Chicago who studies the physics of nano-sized objects. Outside the lab, she freelances for various publications, including National Geographic, Scientific American, Science News, Slate, and others. She is Smithsonian's 2021 AAS Mass Media Fellow. Follow her on Twitter at goes_by_Kim. Now, on a lighter note, how 101 Dalmatians saved Disney. 60 years ago, the company modernized animation when it used Xerox technology on the classic film by Gia Yet, I'll spell that last name, Yetikyel. Take a closer look at Walt Disney's 1961 animated 101 Dalmatians film, and you may notice its animation style looks a little different from its predecessors. With its dark outlines defining characters from backgrounds, its departure from the subtle and sensitive animation of Sleeping Beauty just 2 years prior was considered jarring to some. That's because the film is completely Xeroxed. The technology invented by American physicist Chester Carlson in the 1940s completely streamlined the animation process and ultimately saved Disney's beloved animation department. The lines were often very loose because they were the animator's drawings, not assistant cleanup drawings. It really was a brand new look, says Andrea Dija, former Walt Disney animator and Disney legend, about Xerox animation. Dija is well known for his work in Beauty and the Beast in 1991, Aladdin in 1992, and The Lion King in 1994, and more recently Enchanted 2007 and The Princess and the Frog 2009. With animation growing more expensive, tedious, and time-consuming in the mid-20th century, Xeroxing allowed animators to copy drawings on transparent celluloid sheets using a Xerox camera rather than having artists and assistants hand-trace them. Prior to this experiment with Dalmatians, based off of Dodie Smith's 1956 novel, The 101 Dalmatian, artists first drew concept art to create a character. They sketched characters on animation paper or cheap newsprint, and then assistants cleaned up the sketches, making sure they were uniform. Consistency was key for characters, as assistants had to follow every detail of a sketch, down to the buttons on a jacket. Once the drawings were ready, they moved to the inkers, who traced the sketches on the front side of shiny cell sheets. After drying, the cell was then turned over for painters to paint the characters within those lines to get them as opaque as possible. The line work grew even more complicated. Different colors, weights, and thicknesses were vital for giving animated characters the realistic qualities viewers expected. The colors of the paint also demanded extreme attention. Disney mixed its own paint, making their animations unlike any other. In fact, the woman in the ink and paint department took rouge from their compacts and applied it to Snow White's cheeks to give her natural look in the 1937 film. Disney movies tend to have 12 to 24 images or cells per second, meaning that thousands of cells, if not more, go into a single animated film. Sleeping Beauty, for instance, required nearly 1 million drawings. In fact, it was Sleeping Beauty that set the stage for the new Xerox technique. Considered a classic film now, the film didn't perform nearly as well as expected at the box office. The incredibly detailed work of art took $6 million to make, and it made only a little over $5 million, resulting in a loss of nearly $1 million. In its aftermath, Disney discussed shrinking the budgets for future projects and even closing down the animation studio. But in a money-saving effort, Ken Anderson, art director for Dalmatians, the next film in the works, suggested using Xerox. The technique had been tested on a few animated shorts. Goliath 2 was one of these trial runs, says Dija. The 1960 animated short was written by Bill Peet, who also single-handedly storyboarded Dalmatians, setting the scenery and the continuity of the film's camera shots. While some inkers still made small corrections to the animator's sketches before they were Xerox, these jobs were mostly replaced by Xerox machines, mechanizing the tracing process. The polished sketches went straight to a Xerox machine, which copied them onto cells. Then these cells went to the paint department, where artists flipped them over and painted the characters. The difference in visual effect between the original method of animation used by Disney from the 1930s to the 60s and Xerox animation laid in the lines. The powder or toner never clung perfectly and sometimes flaked off of the lines a bit due to the slickness of the cell. In Xerox animation, characters and backgrounds were outlined in one color, black, brown, or gray. The character Roger Radcliffe in Dalmatians was entirely outlined in black. These dark lines often come off as harsh, whereas animators in the original style could outline characters with multiple colors, giving the drawings a gentler, more gradient look. Aurora from Sleeping Beauty had yellow outlines to match her hair and blue outlines to match her dress. The lines have this kind of friable quality to them. They're a little bit crumbly and uneven, says Charles Solomon, Disney animation critic and historian. If you look at a still from Dalmatians, you'll see the line isn't that perfect, elegant, calligraphic stroke that you saw in the older films. While Walt Disney didn't necessarily dislike Xeroxing, he found it hard to get used to the harsh look, especially for a story like Dalmatians that he adored. It took a few more films before he softened his attitude toward it, said Dujah. He was also more concerned with upholding Disney's iconic quality and charm than with finances. Walt never worried about money. To him, it was just something you could spend to do the things you wanted to do, said Solomon. Animators, on the other hand, praised the new technique. This was the first time their sketches weren't altered through the tracing and copying process. Animators felt like with each tracing step, the drawings lose life, said Dujah. And all of a sudden, their drawings were kept. Dalmatians was actually well-suited for Xeroxing. Think of how tedious animating all 101 spotted dogs would have been by hand. An animator could do groups of two or three or four puppies, and then by staggering their motion, you could expand that to however many puppies you needed for that scene. Well, I hope you've enjoyed today's readings. I certainly have. I hope you'll join us next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.